15. I did not go to Tarenna's nude swimming party, nor did Spencer Reynolds, whom I last saw speaking earnestly with Sudette Cheer. I do not know whether Monsignor Edouard gave in to Tarenna's enticements. Dinner was not quite over. Relief Fund chair people were giving short speeches, and many of the more important senators had already begun to fidget, when Leigh Hunt whispered to me that the CEO's party was ready to leave and my presence was requested. It was almost 2300 hours Webb Standard Time, and I assumed the group would be returning to Government House, but when I stepped through the one-time portal, I was the last in the party to do so, except for the Praetorian bodyguards bringing up the rear of the group. I was shocked to be looking down a stone-walled corridor relieved by long windows showing a Martian sunrise. Technically, Mars is not in the web. The oldest extraterrestrial colony of humankind is made deliberately difficult to reach. Zen-Gnostic pilgrims traveling to the Master's Rock in Hellas Basin have to cast to the home system station and take shuttles from Ganymede or Europa to Mars. It is an inconvenience of only a few hours, but to a society where everything is literally 10 steps away, it makes for a sense of sacrifice and adventure. Other than for historians and experts in brandy cactus agriculture, there are few professional reasons to be drawn to Mars. With the gradual decline of Zen Gnosticism during the past century, even the pilgrim traffic there has grown lighter. No one cares for Mars. Except for Force. Although the Force administrative offices are on TC squared and the bases are spread through the web and protectorate, Mars remains the true home of the military organization, with the Olympus Command School as the heart. There was a small group of military VIPs waiting to greet the small group of political VIPs, and while the clusters swirled like colliding galaxies, I walked over to a window and stared. The corridor was part of a complex carved into the upper lip of Mons Olympus, and from where we stood, some 10 miles high, it felt as if one could take in half the planet with a single glance. From this point, the world was the ancient shield volcano. And the trick of distance reduced access roads, the old city along the cliff walls, and the Tharsis Plateau slums and forests to mere squiggles in a red landscape which looked unchanged from the time the first human set foot on that world, proclaimed it for a nation called Japan, and snapped a photograph. I was watching a small sunrise, thinking, that is the sun. Enjoying the incredible play of light on the clouds creeping out of darkness up the side of the interminable mountainside, when Leigh Hunt stepped closer. "The CEO will see you after the conference." He handed me 2 sketchbooks, which one of the aides had brought from Government House. "You realize that everything you hear and see in this conference is highly classified." I did not treat the statement as a question. Wide bronze doors opened in the stone walls, and guide lights switched on, showing the carpeted ramp and staircase leading to the war room table in the center of a wide, black place, which might have been a massive auditorium sunk in a darkness absolute except for the single, small island of illumination. Aides hurried to show the way, pull out chairs, and blend back into the shadows. With reluctance, I turned my back on the sunrise and followed our party into the pit. General Morpurgo and a troika of other Force leaders handled this briefing personally. The graphics were light years away from the crude call-ups and hollows of the Government House briefing. We were in a vast space, large enough to hold all 8,000 cadets and staff when required. But now, most of the blackness above us was filled with Omega-quality hollows and diagrams the size of freeball fields. It was frightening in a way. So was the content of the briefing.
"We're losing this struggle in Hyperion system," Morpurgo concluded. "At best we will achieve a draw, with the ouster swarm held at bay beyond a perimeter some 15 AU from the Farcaster singularity sphere, with attrition from their small ship raids a constant source of harassment. At worst, we will have to fall back to defensive positions while we evacuate the fleet and Hegemony's citizens and allow Hyperion to fall into Ouster hands. What happened to the knockout blow we were promised? Asked Senator Kolchev from his place near the head of the diamond-shaped table. The decisive attacks on the swarm. Morpurgo cleared his throat, but glanced at Admiral Nishita, who rose. The Force Space Commander's black uniform left the illusion of only his scowling face floating in darkness. I felt a tug of déjà vu at the thought of that image, but I looked back at Mayna Gladstone, illuminated now by the war charts and colors floating above us like a hollow-spectrum version of Damocles's famous sword, and commenced drawing again. I had put away the paper sketch pad and now used my light stylus on a flexible call-up sheet. First, our intelligence on the swarms was necessarily limited, began Nishita. Graphics changed above us. Recon probes and long-distance scouts could not tell us the full nature of every unit in the Ouster migration fleet. The result has been an obvious and serious underestimation of actual combat strength in this particular swarm. Our efforts to penetrate swarm defenses, using only long-range attack fighters and torch ships, has not been as successful as we had hoped. Second, the requirement of maintaining a secure defensive perimeter of such a magnitude in the Hyperion system has made such demands on our two operative task forces that it has been impossible to devote sufficient numbers of ships to an offensive capability at this time. Kolchev interrupted. Admiral, what I hear you saying is that you have too few ships to carry out the mission of destroying or beating off this Ouster attack on Hyperion system. Is that correct? Nishita stared at the senator, and I was reminded of paintings I had seen of samurai in the seconds before the killing sword was removed from its scabbard. That is correct, Senator Kolchev. Yet in our war cabinet briefings, as recently as a standard week ago, you assured us that the two task forces would be enough to protect Hyperion from invasion or destruction, and to deliver a knockout blow to this Ouster swarm. What happened, Admiral?
Nishita drew himself up to his full height, greater than Morpurgo's, but still shorter than Webb average, and turned his gaze toward Gladstone.
M. Executive, I have explained the variables that require an alteration in our battle plan. Shall I begin this briefing again?
Mayna Gladstone had her elbow on the table, and her right hand supported her head with two fingers against her cheek, two under her chin and a thumb along her jawline in a posture of tired attention. Admiral, she said softly, while I believe Senator Kolchev's question is totally pertinent, I think that the situation you have outlined in this briefing and earlier ones today answers it. She turned toward Kolchev. Gabriel, we guessed wrong. With this commitment of force, we get a stalemate at best. The Ousters are meaner, tougher, and more numerous than we thought. She turned her tired gaze back toward Nishita. Admiral, how many more ships will you need? Nishita took a breath, obviously thrown off stride at being asked this question so early in the briefing. He glanced at Morpurgo and the other joint chiefs and then folded his hands in front of his crotch like a funeral director.
200 warships, he said. At least 200. It is a minimum number.
A stir went through the room. I looked up from my drawing. Everyone was whispering or changing position except Gladstone. It took a second for me to understand. The entire Force space fleet of warships numbered fewer than 600. Of course, each was hideously expensive. Few planetary economies could afford to build more than one or two interstellar capital ships, and even a handful of torch ships equipped with Hawking drives could bankrupt a colonial world. And each was hideously powerful. An attack carrier could destroy a world. A force of cruisers and spinship destroyers could destroy a sun. It was conceivable that the Hegemony ships already massed in Hyperion system could, if vectored through the Force Large Transit Farcaster Matrix, destroy most of the star systems in the web. It had taken fewer than 50 ships of the type Nishita was requesting to destroy the Glennon Height fleet a century earlier and to quell the mutiny forever. But the real problem behind Nishita's request was the commitment of two-thirds of the hegemony's fleet in the Hyperion system at one time. I could feel the anxiety flow through the politicians and policymakers like an electrical current. Senator Richaud from Renaissance Vector cleared her throat.
Admiral, we've never concentrated fleet forces like that before, have we?
Nishita's head pivoted as smoothly as if it were on bearings. The scowl did not flicker.
We have never committed ourselves to a fleet action of this importance to the future of the hegemony, Senator Richaud.
Yes, I understand that, said Richaud. But my question was meant to ask what impact this would have on web defenses elsewhere. Isn't that a terrible gamble?
Nishita grunted, and the graphics in the vast space behind him swirled, misted, and coalesced as a stunning view of the Milky Way galaxy, as seen from far above the plane of the ecliptic. The angle changed as we seemed to rush at dizzying speed toward one spiral arm until the blue latticework of the Farcaster web became visible. The hegemony, an irregular gold nucleus, with spires and pseudopods extending into the green nimbus of the protectorate. The web seemed both random in design and dwarfed by the sheer size of the galaxy. And both of these impressions were accurate reflections of reality. Suddenly the graphic shifted, and the web in colonial worlds became the universe, except for a spattering of a few hundred stars to give it perspective.
These represent the position of our fleet elements at this time, said Admiral Nishita.
Amidst and beyond the gold and green, several hundred specks of intense orange appeared. The heaviest concentration was around a distant protectorate star I recognized belatedly as Hyperion's.
And these the ouster swarms, as of their most recent plottings.
A dozen red lines appeared, vector signs and blue shift tails showing the direction of travel. Even at this scale, none of the swarm vectors appeared to intersect hegemony space except for the swarm, a large one, that seemed to be curving into Hyperion system. I noticed that forced space deployments frequently reflected swarm vectors, except for clusterings near bases and troublesome worlds such as Maui Covenant, Brescia, and Coom Riad.
Admiral, said Gladstone, preempting any description of these deployments, I presume you have taken into account fleet reaction time should there be a threat to some other point in our frontier.
Nishita's scowl twitched into something that might have been a smile. There was a hint of condescension in his voice.
Yes, CEO. If you notice the closest swarms besides the one at Hyperion.
The view zoomed toward red vectors above a gold cloud, which embraced star systems I was fairly certain included Heaven's Gate, God's Grove, and Mar Infinitus. At this scale, the ouster threat seemed very distant indeed.
We plot swarm migrations according to Hawking drive wakes picked up by listening posts in and beyond the web. In addition, our long-distance probes verify swarm size and direction on a frequent basis.
How frequent, Admiral? Asked Senator Kolchev.
At least once every few years, snapped the Admiral. You must realize that travel time is many months, even at spinship velocities, and the time debt from our viewpoint may be as much as 12 years for such a transit.
With gaps of years between direct observations, persisted the Senator, how do you know where the swarms are at any given time?
Hawking drives do not lie, Senator.
Nishita's voice was absolutely flat.
It is impossible to simulate the Hawking distortion wake. What we are looking at is the real-time location of hundreds, or in the case of the larger swarms, thousands, of singularity drives underway. As with fatline broadcasts, there is no time debt for transmission of the Hawking effect.
Yes, said Kolchev, his voice as flat and deadly as the Admiral's. But what if the swarms were traveling at less than spinship velocities?
Nishita actually smiled.
Below hyperlight velocity, Senator.
Yes.
I could see more Purgo and a few of the other military men shake their heads or hide smiles. Only the young 4C commander, William Ajunta Lee, was leaning forward attentively with a serious expression.
At sublight velocities,
deadpanned Admiral Nishita.
Our great-great-grandchildren might have to worry about warning their grandchildren of an invasion.
Kolchev would not desist. He stood and pointed toward where the closest swarm curved away from the hegemony above Heaven's Gate.
What about if this swarm were to approach without Hawking drives?
Nishita sighed, obviously irritated at having the substance of the meeting suborned by irrelevancies.
Senator, I assure you that if that swarm turned off their drives now, and turned toward the web now, it would be...
Nishita's eyes blinked as he consulted his implants and comlinks.
230 standard years before they approached our frontiers. It is not a factor in this decision, Senator.
Mayna Gladstone leaned forward, and all eyes shifted toward her. I stored my previous sketch in the call-up and started a new one.
Admiral, it seems to me the real concern here is both the unprecedented nature of this concentration of forces near Hyperion, and the fact that we're putting all of our eggs in one basket.
There was a murmur of amusement around the table. Gladstone was famous for aphorisms, stories, and clichés so old and forgotten that they were brand new. This might have been one of them.
Are we putting all of our eggs in one basket? She continued.
Nishita stepped forward and set his hands on the table, long fingers extended, pressing down with great intensity. That intensity matched the power of the small man's personality. He was one of those rare individuals who commanded others' attention and obedience without effort.
No, CEO, we are not.
Without turning, he gestured toward the display above and behind him.
The closest swarms could not approach hegemony space without a warning time of 2 months in Hawking Drive, and that is 3 years of our time. It would take our fleet units in Hyperion, even assuming they were widely deployed and in a combat situation, less than 5 hours to fall back and translate anywhere in the web.
That does not include fleet units beyond the web, said Senator Richaud. The colonies cannot be left unprotected.
Nishita gestured again.
The 200 warships we will call in to make the Hyperion campaign decisive are those already within the web or those carrying jump ship forecaster capabilities. None of the independent fleet units assigned to the colonies will be affected.
Gladstone nodded.
But what if the Hyperion portal were damaged or seized by the ousters?
From the shifting, nodding, and exhalations from the civilians around the table, I guessed that she had hit upon the major concern. Nishita nodded and strode back to the small dais as if this were the question he had been anticipating, and was pleased irrelevancies were at an end.
Excellent question, he said. It has been mentioned in previous briefings, but I will cover this possibility in some detail. First, we have redundancy in our forecaster capability. With no fewer than 2 jump ships in system at this time, and plans for 3 more when the reinforced task force arrives. The chances of all 5 of these ships being destroyed are very, very small. Almost insignificant when one considers our enhanced defensive capabilities with the reinforced task force. Second, chances of the ousters seizing an intact military forecaster and using it to invade the web are nil. Each ship, each individual that transits a force portal must be identified by tamper-proof coded microtransponders, which are updated daily.
Couldn't the ousters break these codes and insert their own? Asked Senator Kolchev.
Impossible.
Nishita was striding back and forth on the small dais, hands behind his back.
The updating of codes is done daily via Fatline, one-time pads from force headquarters within the web.
Excuse me, I said, amazed to hear my own voice here. But I made a brief visit to Hyperion system this morning, and was aware of no codes. Heads turned. Admiral Nishita again carried out his successful impression of an owl turning its head on frictionless bearings.
Nonetheless, M. Severn, he said, you and M. Hunt were encoded, painlessly and unobtrusively by infrared lasers at both ends of the forecaster transit.
I nodded. Amazed for a second that the Admiral had remembered my name until I realized that he also had implants.
Third,
continued Nishita, as if I had not spoken,
Should the impossible happen, and Auster forces overwhelm our defenses, capture our forecasters intact, circumvent the fail-safe transit code system, and activate a technology with which they are not familiar and which we have denied them for more than 4 centuries, that all their efforts would still be for naught, because all military traffic is being routed to Hyperion via the base at Mudya.
Where? Came a chorus of voices. I had heard of Mudya only through Braun Lamia's tale of her client's death. Both she and Nishita pronounced it Mudya.
Mudya,
repeated Admiral Nishita, smiling now in earnest. It was an oddly boyish smile.
Do not query your comlogs, gentlemen and ladies. Mudya is a black system, not found in any inventories or civilian farcaster charts. We reserve it for just such purposes. With only one habitable planet, fit only for mining and our bases, Mudya is the ultimate fallback position. Should Auster warships do the impossible and breach our defenses and portals in Hyperion, the only place they can go is Mudya, where significant amounts of automated firepower are directed toward anything and everything that comes through. Should the impossible be squared and their fleet survive transit to the Mudya system, outgoing farcaster connections would automatically self-destruct, and their warships would be stranded years from the web.
Yes, said Senator Richaud. But so would ours. 2/3 of our fleet would be left in Hyperion system.
Nishita stood at parade rest.
This is true,
he said,
and certainly the Joint Chiefs and I have weighed the consequences of this remote, one would have to say statistically impossible, event many times. We find the risks acceptable. Should the impossible happen, we still would have more than 200 warships in reserve to defend the web. At worst, we would have lost the Hyperion system after dealing a terrible blow to the Austers, one which would, in and of itself, almost certainly deter any future aggression. But this is not the outcome we anticipate. With 200 warships transferred soon, within the next 8 standard hours, our predictors and the AI Advisory Council predictors see a 99% probability of total defeat of the aggressive Auster swarm, with inconsequential losses to our forces.
Mayna Gladstone turned toward Counselor Albedo. In the low light, the projection was perfect. Counselor, I did not know the advisory group had been asked this question. Is the 99% probability figure reliable? Albedo smiled.
Quite reliable, CEO. And the probability factor was 99.962794%.
The smile broadened.
Quite reassuring enough to have one put all one's eggs into one basket for a short while.
Gladstone did not smile. Admiral, how long after you get the reinforcements do you see the fighting going on?
1 standard week, CEO, at the most.
Gladstone's left eye rose slightly. So short a time.
Yes, CEO.
General Morpurgo, thoughts from Force Ground?
We concur, CEO. Reinforcement is necessary, and at once. Transports will carry approximately 100,000 Marines and ground troops for the mopping up in the remnants of the swarm.
In 7 standard days or less?
Yes, CEO.
Admiral Singh?
Absolutely necessary, CEO.
General von Zeit. One by one, Gladstone polled the Joint Chiefs and top-ranking military there, even asking the commandant of the Olympus Command School, who swelled with pride at being consulted. One by one, she received their unequivocal advice to reinforce. Commander Lee. All gazes shifted toward the young naval officer. I noticed the stiffness of posture and scowls of the senior military men, and suddenly realized that Lee was there at the invitation of the CEO, rather than the benevolence of his superiors. I remembered that Gladstone had been quoted as saying that young Commander Lee showed the kind of initiative and intelligence which Force had sometimes lacked. I suspected that the man's career was forfeit for attending this meeting. Commander William Ajunta Lee shifted uncomfortably in his comfortable chair.
With all due respect, CEO, I'm a mere junior naval officer, and I'm not qualified to give an opinion on matters of such strategic importance.
Gladstone did not smile. Her nod was almost imperceptible.
I appreciate that, Commander. I am sure your superiors here do also. However, in this case, I wonder if you would indulge me and comment on the issue at hand.
Lee sat upright. For an instant his eyes held both conviction and the desperation of a small, trapped animal.
Well then, CEO, if I must comment, I have to say that my own instincts, and they are only instincts, I am profoundly ignorant of interstellar tactics, would advise me against this reinforcement.
Lee took a breath.
This is a purely military assessment, CEO. I know nothing of the political ramifications of defending Hyperion system.
Gladstone leaned forward.
Then on a purely military basis, Commander, why do you oppose the reinforcements?
From where I sat half a table away, I could feel the impact of the Force Chief's gazes, like one of the 100 million joule laser blasts used to ignite deuterium-tritium spheres in one of the ancient inertial confinement fusion reactors. I was amazed that Lee did not collapse, implode, ignite, and fuse before our very eyes.
On a military basis,
Lee said, his eyes hopeless but his voice steady.
The two biggest sins one can commit are to divide one's forces and to, as you put it, CEO, put all of your eggs in a single basket. And in this case, the basket is not even of our own making.
Gladstone nodded and sat back, steepling her fingers beneath her lower lip.
Commander,
said General Morpurgo, and I discovered that a word could indeed be spat.
Now that we have the benefit of your advice, could I ask if you have ever been involved in a space battle?
No, sir.
Have you ever been trained for a space battle, Commander?
Except for the minimal amount required in OCS, which amounts to a few history courses, no, sir, I have not.
Have you ever been involved in any strategic planning above the level of... How many naval surface ships did you command on Maui, Covenant, Commander?
One, sir.
One, breathed Morpurgo. A large ship, Commander?
No, sir.
Were you given command of this ship, Commander? Did you earn it? Or did it fall to you through the vicissitudes of war?
Our captain was killed, sir. I took command by default. It was the final naval action of the Maui Covenant campaign, and...
That will be all, Commander.
Morpurgo turned his back on the war hero and addressed the CEO.
Do you wish to poll us again, ma'am?
Gladstone shook her head. Senator Kolchev cleared his throat.
Perhaps we should have a closed cabinet meeting at Government House.
No need, said Mayna Gladstone. I've decided. Admiral Singh, you are authorized to divert as many fleet units to the Hyperion system as you and the Joint Chiefs see fit.
Yes, CEO.
Admiral Nishita, I will expect a successful termination of hostilities within one standard week of the time you have adequate reinforcements. She looked around the table.
Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot stress to you enough the importance of our possession of Hyperion and the deterrent of ouster threats once and for all.
She rose and walked to the base of the ramp, leading up and out into the darkness.
Good evening, gentlemen, ladies.
It was almost 0400 hours Web and Tau SETI Center time when Hunt rapped at my door. I had been fighting sleep for the 3 hours since we cast back. I had just decided that Gladstone had forgotten about me and was beginning to doze when the knock came.
The garden, said Lee Hunt. And for God's sake, tuck your shirt in.
My boots made soft noises on the fine gravel of the path as I wandered the dark lanes. The lanterns and glow globes barely emitted light. The stars were not visible above the courtyard, because of the glare of TC Squared's interminable cities. But the running lights of the orbital habitations moved across the sky like an endless ring of fireflies. Gladstone was sitting on the iron bench near the bridge.
M. Severn, she said,
her voice low. Thank you for joining me. I apologize for it being so late. The cabinet meeting just broke up. I said nothing, and remained standing. I wanted to ask about your visit to Hyperion this morning, she chuckled in the darkness. Yesterday morning. Did you have any impressions? I wondered what she meant. My guess was that the woman had an insatiable appetite for data, no matter how seemingly irrelevant. I did meet someone, I said. Oh? Yes. Dr. Melio Arendez. He was, is,
a friend of M. Weintraub's daughter, finished Gladstone. The child who is aging backward. Do you have any updates on her condition?
Not really, I said. I had a brief nap today, but the dreams were fragmented. And what did the meeting with Dr. Arendez accomplish? I rubbed my chin with fingers suddenly gone cold. His research team has been waiting in the capital for months, I said. They may be our only hope for understanding what's going on with the tombs and the shrike.
Our predictors say that it is important that the pilgrims be left alone until their act is played out, came Gladstone's voice in the darkness. She seemed to be looking to the side, toward the stream. I felt sudden, inexplicable, implacable anger surge through me. Father Hoyt is already played out, I said more sharply than I intended. They could have saved him if the ship had been allowed to rendezvous with the pilgrims. Arendez and his people might be able to save the baby, Rachel, even though there are only a few days left.
Less than 3 days, said Gladstone. Was there anything else? Any impressions of the planet, or Admiral Nishita's command ship, which you found interesting? My hands clenched into fists, relaxed. You won't allow Arendez to fly up to the tombs.
Not now, no.
What about the evacuation of civilians from Hyperion, at least the hegemony citizens?
That is not a possibility at this time.
I started to say something, checked myself. I stared at the sound of the water beneath the bridge.
No other impressions, M. Severn?
No.
Well, I wish you a good night and pleasant dreams. Tomorrow may be a very hectic day, but I do want to talk to you about those dreams at some point.
Good night, I said, and turned on my heel and walked quickly back to my wing of Government House. In the darkness of my room, I called up a Mozart sonata and took 3 tricecobarbitols. Most probably, they would knock me out in a drugged, dreamless sleep, where the ghost of dead Johnny Keats and his even more ghostly pilgrims could not find me. It meant disappointing Mena Gladstone, and that did not dismay me in the least. I thought of Swift Sailor, Gulliver, and his disgust with mankind after his return from the land of the intelligent horses, the Houyhnhnms, a disgust with his own species, which grew to the point that he had to sleep in the stables with the horses just to be reassured by their smell and presence. My last thought before sleep was, to hell with Mena Gladstone, to hell with the war, and to hell with the web, and to hell with dreams.